watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week we'll pick up where we left off with part two in the documentary series by Adam Curtis, The Trap, What Happened to Our Dream of Freedom. And we'll continue with Chapter 18, Breaking Out of the Trap, from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of Education. What both have in common beyond the use of the word trap in their titles is that they lay out how freedom is promised to the people, but its opposite, control, is delivered. Gatto makes clear that this is no accident or unintended consequence, at least when it comes to the compulsory education of children. We have a nation of credulous followers, celebrity worshippers, and vicarious livers because we were trained to be such as children. Gatto traces the project of social engineering from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the desire for a mass-produced culture compatible with a mass-produced economy. Curtis focuses on paranoid and alienated theories of human nature and behavior that stemmed from Cold War think tanks and the doctrine of mutually assured destruction, and their diffusion into areas of thought and practice from economics to psychiatry. This resulted in this view of human nature becoming the standard of normalcy. It centered around the idea that individuals were motivated by what was called, quote, rational self-interest, though it is, in fact, neither rational nor in our interest. Were that indeed the basis of our nature, we would have been extinct long ago, and the fact that we're now so perilously close to extinction should be an indication of how maladaptive and irrational our so-called civilization is. I'd like to begin by reading you an article that illustrates the outcome of this twisted freedom quite well, both its exclusivity and its meaninglessness. The article was published in the London Observer on July 22nd and penned by Paul Harris. The title is Welcome to Richistan, USA. Harris writes, "The American dream of riches for all is turning into a nightmare of inequality, but a backlash is brewing." On the surface, Mark Kane works for a timeshare company. Members pay a one-off sum to join and an annual fee. Then they get to book holiday time in various destinations around the globe. But Solstice clients are not ordinary people. They are America's super rich, and a brief glance at its operations reveal the vast and still widening gulf between them and the rest of America. Solstice has only about 80 members. Platinum membership costs them $875,000 to join, and then a $42,000 annual fee. In return, they get access to 10 homes, from London to California, and a private yacht in the Caribbean, all fully staffed with cooks, cleaners, and lifestyle managers, ready to satisfy any whim from helicopter skiing to audiences with local celebrities. As the firm's marketing manager, Kane knows what Solstice clientele want. "We're trying to feed and manage this insatiable appetite for luxury," Kane said with pride. "America's super rich have returned to the days of the Roaring Twenties. As the rest of the country struggles to get by, a huge bubble of multimillionaires lives in almost a parallel world. The rich now live in their own world of private education, private health care, and gated mansions. They have their own schools and their own banks. They even travel apart, creating a booming industry of private jets and yachts. Their world now has a name, thanks to a new book by Wall Street Journal reporter Robert Frank, which has dubbed it Richistan. There, every dream can come true. But for the American dream itself, which promises everyone can join the elite, the emergence of Richistan is a mixed blessing. We in America are heading toward developing nation levels of inequality. We would become like Brazil. What does that say about us? What does that say about America?" Frank said. In 1985, there were just 13 U.S. billionaires. Now there are more than 1,000. In 2005, the U.S. saw 227,000 new millionaires being created. One survey showed that the wealth of all U.S. millionaires was $30 trillion, more than the GDPs of China, Japan, Brazil, Russia, and the EU combined. The rich have now created their own economy for their needs at a time when the average worker's wage rises will merely match inflation, and where 36 million people live below the poverty line. In Richistan, sums of money are rendered almost meaningless because of their size. It also has other names. There is the Platinum Triangle, used to describe the slice of Beverly Hills, where many houses go for above $10 million. Then there is the Jewel Coast, used to describe the strip of Madison Avenue in Manhattan, where boutique jewelry stores have sprung up to cater for the new rich's needs. Or it exists in the Met Circle Society, a Manhattan club open only to those whose net worth is at least $100 million. The reason behind the sudden wealth boom is, according to some experts, the convergence of a new technology, the internet and other computing advances, with fluid and speculative markets. It was the same in the late 19th century when the original Gilded Age of conspicuous wealth and deep poverty was spawned by railways and the industrial age. At the same time, government has helped by doling out corporate tax breaks. In the 50s, the proportion of federal income from company taxes was 33%. By 2003, it was just 7.4%. Some 82 of America's largest companies paid no tax at all in at least one of the first 3 years of the administration of President George W. Bush. But who are the new rich? Some of the names are familiar. Microsoft tycoon Bill Gates and savvy stock investor Warren Buffett. But most are unknown, often springing from the secretive world of financial hedge funds. Men like James Simons, who took home compensation of $1.7 billion last year. Last year, the 25 top-earning hedge fund bankers in the U.S. earned an average of $570 million each. The average U.S. household income is $50,000. It is such men, and they are usually men, who feed the outlandish luxury goods economy of Richistan. It is they who are responsible for the rebirth of the butler industry, which was all but dead in the 70s and is now facing a shortage of trained staff. So keen is the demand that many can expect to earn a six-figure salary when they graduate from booming butler schools. Then there is the runaway feeder industry of luxury consumer items. The new ultra-rich turn up their noses at Rolexes, The sought-after brand is Frank Muller, which sells a high-end timepiece for $736,000. Or try a Mont Blanc pen, encrusted in jewels, for $700,000. Louis Vuitton's most exclusive handbag sells for $42,000. Only 24 were ever made, and none ever touched a shelf, as all were pre-sold to rich Hispanic clients. In places such as Manhattan and Los Angeles, restaurants and bars outdo themselves in excess. New York's Algonquin Hotel has a $10,000 martini on a rock. It comes with a diamond at the bottom of the glass. City eateries sell burgers for more than $50. One offers a $1,000 omelet. In Los Angeles, there is a craze for bling mineral water at $90 a bottle. Then there are the boats. The private yacht industry in America has been caught in an arms race of size and luxuriousness. So far, there has been a clear winner. Oracle founder Larry Ellison's 450-foot water palace, the Rising Sun. More than 80 rooms on 5 stories and a landing craft that carries a jeep, a basketball court doubling as a helipad, and a fully equipped cinema. Now an Oregon-based company is taking things further. Private submarines. An estimated 100 or so private subs are now drifting around the world's oceans. Then there are the rockets. Several notable billionaires are now leading the way in private exploration of space. One of them is Robert Bigelow, who has plowed $500 million into trying to build an inflatable space hotel. A miniature prototype model was successfully launched and tested last month. In a scene that perhaps James Bond would find familiar, armed guards now patrol the fences of Bigelow's aerospace headquarters, wearing badges decorated with an alien as their corporate logo. But this is not just a world of riches gone mad that the rest of America can ignore. The growth of such a large super-rich class, coupled with a deepening poverty in many communities, is starting to tear at the fabric of society. Even some of the most wealthy, like Gates and Buffett, have spoken openly of the needs to address the massive inequality gap that they have come to exemplify. In effect, some of the very richest Americans are calling for themselves to be taxed. In a speech last month, Buffett, the third richest man in the world, pointed out that his tax rate was 17.7% of his income, while his secretary was taxed at 30%. Many of the new super rich are looking long term at the world, and they are seeing a collapsing U.S. education system and healthcare system, and the disappearance of the middle class. And they realize this is bad for everybody, said Frank. Defenders of low tax for the rich point to the theory of trickle-down economics, the spending power of the rich benefiting the poor. But while the super-rich have boomed, the earning power of the average and poor citizen has not nearly matched the performance of the elite. In 2005, the top 1% of earners in the U.S. gained 14% in income in real terms, while the rest of the country gained less than 1%. The situation is especially bad for the severely poor, those living at half the poverty level, whose numbers are at a 32-year high. The rich are getting richer, but are not bringing everyone else with them. If you look at the impact of the last 20 years, it seems pretty clear that trickle-down just does not work, said Paul Buchheit, economics professor at Chicago's Harold Washington College. There are some signs of a change in attitude. Recent huge Wall Street flotations, such as a listing of private equity giants like Blackstone, have created a push in Congress for taxes on the instant billionaires they've created. Scandals of excess, such as Enron and WorldCom, and the trial of Conrad Black have been high profile. But few politicians needing campaign cash from new millionaires will get far preaching higher tax. Calls for more equality tend to have come from men like Buffett and Gates, whose fortunes are so enormous that a little extra tax would make no difference. Bush has pushed to phase out taxes like the estate tax, which benefits only the rich. I don't see it changing, no matter what administration is in power, said Buckhite. But many think it must change. To a large degree, the debate over the booming lives of the super-rich is an argument about the American soul. It is a country that has always worshipped wealth, where the creation of a fortune was seen as virtuous and a source of pride. Now that huge wealth has started to squeeze the, quote, middle class out of existence, leaving the haves and have-nots in very separate worlds. It is possible that political will may develop to address the problem, or that the problem will correct itself. The notorious end of the Gilded Age came in the panic of 1893 that sank America into depression. Frank believes the signs of a coming storm are there. The trick is to spot when prosperity turns to excess, he said. When a large amount of people make a lot of money very quickly, it's a sign you're near the top of the market, close quote. In a world of mega yachts, private submarines, and space hotels, that peak might be close at hand. And it's a long way down. There are 7.5 million households in America worth up to $10 million. A further 2 million are worth $10 million to $100 million, and thousands are worth more than $100 million. There is now a two-year waiting list for 200-foot yachts. If put end-to-end, the boats on that list, which cost $50 million each, would be 15 miles long. Sebanak Golf Club in the Hamptons, Long Island, charges $650,000 for membership. That doesn't include the $12,000 annual dues or tips for caddies. Google founders Sergey Brin and Larry Page have a private Boeing 767. John D. Rockefeller was America's first billionaire. Adjusted for inflation, he had $14 billion, less than the net worth of each of Sam Walton's five children today. There were 13 U.S. billionaires in 1985. Now there are more than 1,000. There are as many millionaires in North Carolina as in India. Affluent is Richistani for not really rich. According to Frank, you need about $10 million to be considered entry-level rich. And that Welcome to Richistan USA by Paul Harris from the July 22nd edition of the London Observer.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
The ultimate political goal at the heart of our age is the idea of individual freedom.
I believe that freedom is the future of all humanity.
In Britain, our government...
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
The ultimate political goal at the heart of our age is the idea of individual freedom.
I believe that freedom is the future of all humanity.
In Britain, our government has set out to create a revolution that will free individuals from the control of old elites and bureaucracies. A new world where we are free to choose our lives, not be trapped by class or income into a predestined role.
To liberate Britain from all the old class divisions, old structures, old prejudices.
To liberate the individual.
And abroad, in Iraq and Afghanistan, Britain and America have set out to liberate individuals from tyranny. For those leading it, it is just a first step in a global revolution for democracy. But if one steps back and looks at what has resulted, it is a very strange kind of freedom. The attempt to liberate people from the dead hand of bureaucracy has led to the rise of a new and increasingly controlling system of management, driven by targets and numbers. While governments committed to creating freedom of choice in all areas have actually presided over a rise of inequalities and a dramatic collapse in social mobility. The consequence has been a return of the power of class and privilege. And abroad, the attempt to create democracy has led not just to bloody mayhem, but a rejection of the American-led campaign to bring freedom.
Go home, Yankee! Go home, Yankee!
We're here for your fucking freedom! So back up right now!
And it has summoned up an anti-democratic, authoritarian Islamism. And this, in turn, has helped inspire terrorist attacks in Britain itself. In response, the government has dismantled long-standing laws designed to protect our freedom. This is a series of films about how this strange, paradoxical world came to be created. This episode tells the story of how in the 1990s, politicians from both the right and the left tried to extend an idea of freedom, modelled on the freedom of the market, to all other areas of society. This was something that previously no one, not even the high priest of capitalism, Adam Smith, had thought possible or appropriate. But now, it was seen as inevitable, as underlying it was a scientific model of ourselves, as simplified robots, rational, calculating beings whose behaviour and even feelings could be analysed and managed by numbers. But what resulted was the very opposite of freedom. The numbers took on a power of their own, which began to create new forms of control, greater inequalities, and the return of a rigid class structure based on the power of money.
The Trap. What happened to our dream of freedom? Part 2. The Lonely Robot.
In 1991, the new leader of the Conservative Party, John Major, was searching for what his advisers called the vision thing, a policy that would define his time in office.
Can we turn left into Atlantic Road in a moment, please? I think I'd like to go down there and have a look. Is it still there? It is. It is. It's still there. It's still there.
Pattern was set and the world divided. Not into male and female. Oh, no, no, no. That's just a mere superficial division of minor importance. No, gentlemen, there is another division. Another dichotomy. More basic, more profound. At that fateful moment, the world was divided into winners and losers. Top men and underdogs. In a word, the one up and the one down.
And in July, John Major announced that he was going to make Britain a fairer and more equal society. And he was going to start with the public services. The arrogant bureaucrats who had ruled Britain for so long were now going to be made to serve the public. There would be no them and us any longer.
Nothing less than a revolution in the way in which public services are delivered. It will be the most comprehensive quality initiative ever launched. New and tougher standards of services will be set. The wide range of mechanisms to ensure they're met to the citizen's satisfaction.
Behind John Major's vision was a radical new political theory which had been born out of the strategic thinking of the Cold War. As last week's programme showed, it argued that the idea of public duty, which had underpinned British public life for generations, was an illusion. In reality, public servants were motivated only by self-interest. When they talked proudly of serving the public good, it was hypocrisy. What they were actually doing was scheming to build up their empires. John Major was setting out to create an alternative system that tried to mimic the self-interested drive of the free market. This would harness the true individualism of public servants in a productive way. The management consultants who designed the systems explained that this was liberation. Once public servants were set performance targets, they could achieve them in any way they wanted, The old bureaucratic rules could be thrown away, and they would become heroic entrepreneurs.
Dispel for good our notions of bureaucratic inefficiency and complacency.
Tom Petras, inventor, liberation management.
These people have visions. They set goals. They constantly seek customer feedback. They beat budgets and pursue innovations with zeal.
Right.
No introduction.
The bureaucracy bashing revolution is underway. It's no longer management by the book. And in fact, the book has been rewritten and in some cases literally thrown out.
And anybody that deals with the public, you can never win. You can never win when you deal with the public. Never.
But this radical new theory had an inexorable logic at its heart. It wasn't going to just attack the old bureaucratic institutions. It was going to go much further. It would undermine the very ideals of democratic politics and the politicians' belief that they could change the world. The man who did most to drive through this logic was one of the most influential economists in the world, James Buchanan. His ideas had fundamentally shaped the conservative revolution in both Britain and America. He argued that politicians, just like the civil servants, were hypocrites. The idea they promoted, that they were serving the public, was a fiction. In reality, they too followed their self-interest.
Professor James Buchanan.
The illusion would be that politics are out, our politicians are out there really seeking to do good for us. Not for themselves, but do good for us. A kind of an optimistic illusion that he's doing good for the public.
Whereas you believe?
We believe that, for the most part, he's after his own interest. I mean, that's where we model his behaviors.
But what about idealism?
Well, I don't know what you mean. You'd have to tell me more about what you mean by the word.
The idea that you're in politics for a greater public good than something you gain for yourself.
Well, I don't think that's meaningful. I don't know how to put any handles on that.
Labour candidate speaks to you. I ask you to support the Labour Party.
What Buchanan argued was that all politicians followed their self-interest, because the idea that they could interpret and express the general will of the people was logically impossible. Behind this view lay not just right-wing ideology, but a scientific theory called game theory. As last week's programme showed, game theory had been used in the 1950s by nuclear strategists. But the idea had then been developed by the mathematical genius John Nash as a way of looking at all social interaction. Individuals lived their lives as a game in which they pursued only their own self-interest, constantly adjusting to each other's strategies. If this were true, the economists argued, then the very idea of the collective people's will was mathematically impossible. You simply cannot add up the millions of competing individual desires into one coherent goal. They called it the impossibility theorem. And the only system they said that could respond to what people really wanted in such an atomized world was the free market, not politics.
Professor Philip Murawski, economic and political philosopher.
In this game theory view of the world, everyone is out for their own personal advantage, and then if you take that as given, then all those individuals want to maximize their pleasure in this very simplified scheme. And that's what the impossibility theorem says. It says they actually do that in the market, but they don't do that in political situations like voting situations.
It's a very narrow view of politics.
Very narrow view of politics. But of course it has to be, because it's a narrow view of the human being. But what it does is it reduces what it means to be a human being to a few relatively mechanical principles. That individuals are little information processors, but the market is the best information processor, and voting, or a democracy, is a weak information processor.
Inefficient.
By the early 90s, this argument had come to dominate not just economics, but also the thinking of those who ran the markets. In 1992, Walter Wriston, the head of Citicorp, the largest bank in the world, wrote a bestseller called The Twilight of Sovereignty. In it, he predicted the coming triumph of a new market democracy. where the market would take over the responsibility for running much of society from the politicians. Markets, he said, are the only true voting machines. If they are left untouched by politicians and regulation, they will truly come to act out the people's will for the first time in modern history. And the bankers were about to find a way of making this happen.
Ohio wants change, America wants change, and Ohio cast 144 votes for the next president.
Yes!
In 1992, Bill Clinton was running for president. Under George Bush Sr., America had slid into depression, and Clinton promised that he would use the political power of the presidency to rescue the nation.
It's time to change America. George Bush, if you won't use your power to help America, step aside, I will. There is no them, there is only us.
Clinton promised to use the power of the state to reform America's health care, extend welfare, and invest in jobs. And above all, reduce the inequalities that had risen up under President Reagan. And at the end of 1992, he was triumphantly elected. But in January, a few days before his inauguration, two leading members of the financial world came to see Clinton in Washington. One was Alan Greenspan, the head of the Federal Reserve. The other was Clinton's new economic advisor, Robert Rubin, the head of Goldman Sachs. What they told the president was dramatic. His political plans were impossible. He was inheriting a huge government deficit, and if he borrowed any more money to pay for his promises, interest rates would rise, people would stop borrowing and spending, and there would be an economic disaster.
Robert Rubin, economic advisor, Clinton administration.
The single most critical meeting with President Clinton with respect to the economic strategy of the Clinton administration was in early January during the transition, about 2 weeks before the inauguration. And it was at that meeting what we were saying to the president was that we need a dramatic change in policy, and it has to be accomplished as much as possible by cutting spending, even though that is very difficult politically.
It was a dramatic message, though, for a Democratic president, wasn't it?
I think any president would have found it a dramatic message, whether Democrat or Republican, to have to start his administration by both reducing programs and cutting spending. And that's very difficult for any politician.
But what both Rubin and Greenspan told Clinton was that there was an alternative way to build a better society. He should let the market do it. Instead of seeing the markets as a dangerous force that politics had to control, he should give away power and let them flourish unrestricted. The markets, they said, were now so intertwined with people's lives that they could respond democratically to people's needs in all aspects of their lives in a way that politics couldn't.
Alan Greenspan communicated a very clear message to Bill Clinton that the economy and people's appetites as expressed in the economy, their buying, their ability to buy, what they prefer, is a better gauge of public sentiment than any other.
Robert Reich, Clinton Cabinet, 1993 to 97.
The economy, to that extent, is superior to democracy. In a democracy, it's less tidy. People can express their preferences only indirectly through their representatives, and their representatives have to express the preferences of a lot of people and sometimes want to express their own preferences rather than their constituents. So in that way of viewing the world, an economy is preferable to a democracy.
Faced with the banker's argument, Clinton agreed, and on taking office began to cut back on his reforms. During his first term, he dismantled much of the welfare structure that had been put in place in the 1930s. He abandoned all his healthcare reforms and cut government regulation of business. It was what the markets wanted. As Greenspan had promised, the economy began to boom. And in 1996, Clinton made a speech that announced the end of the vision of liberal politics, that one could use the power of big government to change the world.
We know big government does not have all the answers, and we have worked to give the American people a smaller, less bureaucratic government in Washington.
And we have to give the American people one that lives within its means. The era of big government is over.
It was the triumph of market democracy, a belief that anyone who gave the public what they wanted was democratic and thus good, as opposed to the old political elites who believed that they knew what was best for us and imposed their idea of what society should be. In the process, businessmen became transformed. They might be greedy and selfish, but they were also engineers of a new kind of freedom. By responding to the needs and desires of individuals, they were interpreting the will of the people in a way that politicians couldn't.
Thomas Frank, political journalist.
If markets are in fact democracy, if markets are a means of consent, a medium of consent, you know, which all these people believe that they are. This is a very, very commonplace view in the United States these days. In fact, this is a consensus view. It's hard to find someone at the upper reaches of broadcasting, journalism, business, whatever, who doesn't think this. If markets, in fact, are a medium of consent, then you've got all sorts of funny things that come out. Then CEOs are the people who the markets have chosen above all others, are in fact men of the people. They're not some kind of bloodthirsty robber baron like Americans thought they were in the 1930s. When they speak to us, they say, "You speak, we listen," or Fox News, "What is it? We report, you decide," you know, or any of these slogans.
The promoters of this idea of market democracy portrayed it as a glorious return to a golden age, a time in the 18th and 19th centuries when laissez-faire capitalism, not politics, had ordered society. But this was a myth. The political philosophers of that time had made a distinction between the self-interest of the marketplace and other areas of social and political life that involved what Adam Smith called moral sentiments. These were sympathy and understanding for others, which were just as important in the ordering of society. What was happening at the end of the 20th century was something that had never been tried before. The idea of democracy was being taken over by a simplified economic model of human beings. And in the process, freedom was redefined to mean nothing more than the ability of individuals to get whatever they wanted.
Robert Reich.
If you go back to the 18th and 19th centuries, most political philosophers and most economists understood that there was a social contract. People were bound together, not as individuals expressing themselves only through the marketplace, but as citizens. We had obligations to one another. We were not simply self-interested individuals purchasing things for ourselves, but we were a community. Our very identities, our moral values, came from our relationships in these communities. The view that the market was preferable to politics as a means of giving people exactly what they wanted. That notion is a rather new idea.
Behind these new ideas about how society should be managed was a model of the individual as a rational, calculating machine whose self-interested behavior could be analyzed by numbers. This simplified version of us had been created back in the Cold War by game theorists. They had made an assumption that we were like that simply in order to make their equations and their models work. But what was now rising up was a powerful scientific proof that this was not just an assumption. It really did describe the very roots of our nature. That everything human beings did and felt had been programmed into us by our gene. And all our actions were the result of rational calculations by that genetic program. That we really were computing machines guided by numbers. The roots of this idea go back to the early 1970s, when geneticists who were studying the behavior of animals made a conceptual shift. They started to look at the animal's behavior from what was called the gene's point of view. And they realized that from this perspective, the animals were simply machines that were being used by the genes to survive and replicate themselves.
Professor John Maynard Smith, geneticist, speaking in 1976.
In effect, we can picture the body of the chicken as being a machine, a device, constructed by the genes to ensure the production of more genes. Now, this may seem a perverse way of looking at things. You may think of reproduction as your method of producing children like yourself. And I'm asking you to look at it in a very different light. The body is simply the gene's device for producing more genes like itself.
Behind this new way of seeing animals was yet again game theory. Game theory had inspired the geneticists because it gave a powerful framework for understanding how the genes dictated behavior. Game theorists looked at society as a system of self-interested individuals competing and strategizing against one another. And the geneticists applied exactly the same model to genes. They developed complicated equations to show how all animal behavior, from violence to altruism, were actually rational strategies played by the genes in a game of survival. The geneticists asserted that the same must be true for human beings. And one scientist did an extraordinary experiment to see whether our genes did control our behavior in the same rational, mathematical way. It took place deep within the Amazon forests. The Yanomamo people were famous for being one of the most violent societies on Earth. An anthropologist studying them decided to see whether behind the chaos of the fighting there was a hidden genetic pattern guiding it in a mathematical way. He was called Napoleon Chagnon, and his first step was to try and find out the names of everyone and who was related to whom.
I assumed at the outset that the natives would be excited and eager and thrilled and flattered that I was interested in their culture and their society and in their families and genealogies. And so I would innocently ask what the name of so-and-so was, and they would give me a name, and I'd write it down. And it turned out that they tricked me, that all of the names that the people in the village I was living in were not only incorrect, but they were derogatory, vulgar, false. Not all of them were vulgar and derogatory, but a lot of them were.
Like what?
Like fart breath, hairy and long dong, things of that sort. Hairy pussy, as the name of the wife of the headman.
But Chagnon persisted. He spent months checking and cross-checking names and relationships. He also gave out Western goods, above all the prize machete, in return for information, until he had built up what he believed was an accurate database of the names and genealogies of 6,000 Yanomami, which he then stored on a computer at his university. Chagnon then returned with a film crew and recorded in great detail a fight in a village.
Bring your camera over here.
Chagnon returned to America and went through the film frame by frame, identifying all the participants. On the surface, there seemed no meaning to the fight. Often individuals who appeared closely related attacked each other. But when Chagnon fed their details into the computer and cross-checked them with his database, another reality emerged. Because of the Yanomamo's complex history of intermarriage, individuals were related to each other in the most surprising ways. And what the computer showed was that the individuals who took risks for each other in the fight were always more closely genetically related than those they attacked.
There was a hidden pattern in the film, and it was the computer that proved and demonstrated that the pattern was there, because you can't possibly remember everybody's genealogical relatedness to everybody else in the village. So underneath all of this chaos and confusion and what meets the eye, there were people who shared genes with each other and chose sides on the basis of their relatedness to each other. Yeah, there's kind of a hidden mathematical dimension to the whole thing that you have to really dig for to discover.
Chagnon's experiment caused a sensation within the human sciences, because it seemed to offer precise mathematical proof that genes played a powerful role in guiding human behavior. It became one of the fundamental pieces of evidence underpinning a new, powerful model of human beings. They were machines whose actions and feelings were driven by coded instructions implanted deep inside them millions of years ago, of which they were unaware. It was an image that began to permeate deep into our culture.
The image of the organism, including ourselves, as a machine for passing on genes, to shift the focus away from the idea of the organism as being the agent in life to the immortal replicator.
Professor Richard Dawkins, speaking in 1987.
Our DNA is a coded description of the worlds in which our ancestors survived.
DNA. It's the computer recipe for life itself. Unraveling like a reel of magnetic tape on some giant computer.
Back in the dark and frightening days of the Cold War, mathematicians had developed a simplified, machine-like model of human beings whose behavior could be analyzed and predicted by numbers. They had done this to try and understand and control the terrifying uncertainties of that time. Now in the 1990s, the Cold War was over and its giant defenses lay empty. But that simplified model had risen up and triumphed as an explanation of what we truly are as human beings, on every level, politically, economically, and now biologically.
Professor Philip Murawski.
We no longer see this theory as having historical inspiration in the Cold War. Instead, what we see it as a kind of quasi-natural social science theory of everything. It applies to something as small as a gene, or something as medium-sized as a human being, or something as large as a nation-state. The human being sort of dissolves in this social theory, that it isn't about necessarily human beings anymore. It's about these little entities that are constantly questing to reproduce themselves and also find their maximum advantage.
And with the rise of this machine model of human beings, a new idea of how to change society began to emerge. Not through politics any longer, but by adjusting how well the individual machines functioned. The technicians of this new idea would be the psychiatrists and the drug companies who would free people from the terrible anxieties inside themselves. But what it would lead to would be a new form of order and control, not defined by the old political elites, by the objective power of numbers.
I just found myself constantly worrying. I just couldn't stop.
My hands were shaking, and I was sure that people were looking at me and watching my hands.
These college students didn't know it then, but they were each experiencing the symptoms of an anxiety disorder. Panic disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, social phobia, and post-traumatic stress disorder.
This year, 23 million Americans will suffer from one of these anxiety disorders. They're the most common mental illness in the country, and they can attack anyone at any time.
In the early 90s, an epidemic of mental disorder was sweeping America and Britain. As last week's program showed, it had been uncovered by a new system for identifying disorders. Psychiatry had been attacked for relying on the personal and fallible judgment of psychiatrists. And instead, a new objective method based on checklists had been invented. These listed only the objective symptoms and deliberately did not inquire into why individuals felt an anxiety. In the late 80s, nationwide surveys had revealed an incredible picture. More than 50% of Americans suffered from mental disorders.
Sad.
But at the very same time, the drug companies had announced that they had created a new type of drug called an SSRI, which they claimed targeted the circuits inside the brain that were causing these malfunctions. The SSRIs were marketed under names like Prozac. What they did was alter the amounts of serotonin that flowed across the circuit connections within the brain, and they readjusted the chemicals to normal levels.
And then all of a sudden, here comes somebody that says, okay, now try these on, try this Prozac on. And I tried it on, and for the first time in my life, I went, whoa, is this the way reality really is?
this pill can solve all of your problems. It's called Prozac, and it may mean the end of depression as we know it.
I've been taking Prozac for 2 years.
And what difference has that made?
Brilliant.
Oh, she's smiling, eyes light up.
And I feel as if I'm back to normal.
You feel normal?
Yeah.
And you feel a better person?
Yeah, yeah.
Through treatment, I learned to function with my disorder, and now life is so much more enjoyable.
Life is so much better now that I've gotten treatment, and I feel like I've got my OCD under control, and it feels really great.
A better life is waiting.
What now began to happen was that millions of people who had been diagnosed by the checklist as disordered went to psychiatrists to be medicated. The result was liberation from anxiety on a wide scale. But in the process, the checklist became a powerful and seemingly objective guide for people as to what should be their normal feelings and what was abnormal. And a number of leading psychiatrists began to argue that what they were actually doing was creating a static society in which human beings were adjusted by the medication so they fitted to an agreed normal type, defined by the checklist.
Paul McHugh, chief psychiatrist, Johns Hopkins Hospital.
People come to me all the time asking me to medicate them. The implication behind that was that human beings, like all other animals, have a particular ideal model. It had a machine-like quality to it. We know what the model should be. And they ask the medications, they ask of me to give them medications that would push them back to this particular model they have, an unrealistic model, but a very static model of man as machine.
Has it worked? You look very dubious, my friend.
Apparently it has. I can't help being suspicious of it. I don't think she's the woman I married.
Why?
I think she's changed.
In what way?
I don't know. I don't know, but there's something there that is different.
Okay, she's not the woman you married. Is she a better woman?
No, she's different.
They imagined that they might live in a world where there would never be a worry, not even a grief, where never did conflict, concern, worry over alternatives make possible the kinds of progress that we've seen in the past.
But then, the man who had created the checklist system admitted that it might actually be leading millions of people to believe that they were disordered when they were not. The checklist added up only observable symptoms. They deliberately excluded any understanding of the patient's life. Because of this, he said, it confused genuine psychological disorder with normal human feelings of sadness and anxiety, and that this was happening on a wide scale. All this was being said by one of America's most powerful psychiatrists, Dr. Robert Spitzer.
What happened is that we made estimates of prevalence of mental disorders totally descriptively, without considering that many of these conditions might be normal reactions, which are not really disorders. That's the problem, because we were not looking at the context in which those conditions developed.
So you have effectively medicalized much of ordinary human sadness, fear, ordinary experiences. You've medicalized them.
I think we have, to some extent. How serious a problem it is not known. I don't know if it's 20%, 30%, I don't know. But that's a considerable amount if it is 20 or 30%.
What was happening was that large parts of normal human experience, grief, disappointment, loneliness, were all being reclassified as medical disorders. In the process, a new system of management was emerging. The drugs took away those complex and difficult feelings and made the individuals happier. But they also made them simpler beings, more easy to predict and manage, and closer to the machine-like creatures at the heart of the economic models.
Dr. Jerome Wakefield, psychiatrist.
By using checklists of symptoms about emotions, you have gone out and confused normal human responses to life with mental disorder, and therefore created an illusion of a vast epidemic, a medicalized illusion. And obviously a situation where you medicalize is a situation where your focus will not be on social change. It will be on controlling individuals to fit in properly. That's the subtle and overall danger here, that it could serve our kind of social economic systems needs in a way in which we become more efficient, but less human.
What the psychiatrists had discovered was that an objective system based on numbers had led them into a trap. The numbers had imposed their own narrow logic on how we thought and felt about ourselves. And the politicians were about to find that their attempts to manage society by using numbers would also have the strangest consequences. Far from helping them achieve their progressive vision, they would actually make society more rigid and even harder to change. In 1997, New Labour was elected. What it promised was a society free of the arrogance and prejudices of the old elites who had dominated Britain's class system for so long.
It is us, the new radicals, a Labour Party modernised, that must undertake this historic mission to liberate Britain from all the old class divisions, old structures, old prejudices, old ways of working and of doing things that will not do in this world of change.
Throughout their campaign, New Labour had modelled themselves on the Clinton Democrats. And now in power, they did exactly what Clinton had done. They gave power away to the banks and the markets. Gordon Brown's first announcement was to abandon the politicians' final lever of control over the economy.
The new Chancellor, Gordon Brown, announces a revolution in economic policy. From now on, the Chancellor will hand control of interest rates to an independent Bank of England.
And in the management of society, New Labour turned to the mathematical systems that John Major had brought in, but on a scale never seen before. They believed that people actually behaved in the way described by the simplified economic model. Performance targets and incentives would be set for everything and everyone. Even cabinet ministers would have to fulfil their performance targets or be punished.
Stephen Byers, Chief Secretary of the Treasury, 1998.
300 or so performance targets, over 150 efficiency targets. Each public service agreement will have a named minister who is responsible for delivering and achieving those targets. They may not have to resign, but they will have to explain why they haven't been able to meet their targets. If a department fails to meet those targets, then it's only right and proper that government will look seriously at their ability to deliver.
The Treasury, under Gordon Brown, created a vast mathematical system. They invented ways of giving numerical values to things that previously no one thought could be measured. Hunger in sub-Saharan Africa was to be reduced to below 48%, while world conflict was to be reduced by 6%. And all the towns and villages in Britain were to be measured for a community vibrancy index. And even the quality of life in the countryside was broken down into a series of indices, one of which measured how much birdsong there should be.
We want a barometer of the indicators of the quality of life, and they're not simply the economic ones. Half of the skylarks have gone since 1970. Now, if you want to measure the quality of the life, then one of the things is that dawn chorus. It's about indices that affect everybody in a quality of life barometer.
The original idea behind the mathematical system was that it would liberate public servants from old forms of bureaucratic control. Once they were given the targets, they were free to achieve them any way they wanted. But almost immediately, New Labour began to discover that people were more complex and devious than the simple model allowed. Public servants began to find the most ingenious ways of hitting their targets.
James Strachan, Chairman of the Audit Commission.
It's about the pressure to meet these targets. It's causing some NHS managers to game the system.